Hello, everyone. This is Danny Bedore, and thanks for listening to another episode. This one is a lengthy episode of a webinar, a Zoom session we have done at the end of December 2023. I would recommend to actually go and watch the video and not listen to the podcast because there are visual aspects to it. However, can you benefit from just listening to the podcast, to the audio? Yes, you can. My style of presentation is more verbal and the slides are supporting it and not 100% visual. So yes, it is possible for the most part. There is a section that we talk about numbers and Excel, etc. That's a little bit more harder to follow without the visual. So if you're here and you're about to listen to this episode and have the ability to watch it online, the link is in the description. You can click the link and watch the visual, but you can still benefit from this very long, or I should say an hour and a half long-ish session with Q&A at the end. I appreciate you taking the time. Your feedback is always welcome, and you're always welcome to reach out to us for a more intimate one-on-one conversation. Enjoy the episode, and I wish you success with your investing. Bye-bye. Okay. I am gonna assume you guys can see, just confirm maybe by raise of hands, that you can see the screen. I know it jumps straight to the disclaimer. Perfect. Excellent. All right. Well, good evening, everyone. It's been a while for me, you know, busy, many busy months, probably since my last presentation in the room, webinar. Always a pleasure. I like doing it. I'm enjoying it. The opportunity to interact, for you to ask questions, for me to answer, to me to get your questions. So that's terrific. Feel free to ask questions as I move forward with the presentation. I'll try to take them during and not just at the end. I will say that sometimes a question comes in and it kind of takes me a little bit off course. So I'll maybe circle back to it when we are getting to the Q&A part at the end. Let me introduce myself. My name is Danny Bedore. I'm the one waving my hand here. In my improved studio with a lot of bright lights that I recently added. So that feels quite overwhelming. I'm originally from Israel, moved to the States 20 years ago, been investing in US real estate for 22 years or so. And I have been my entire career for the past 20 years, been based in California for 10 years in Northern California, 10 years in Southern California, Orange County, and primarily working with real estate investors that most of them live in the West Coast, not only, but most of them live in the West Coast, helping them buy investment rental properties in different parts of the country. I've been doing it, like I said, since in the US since 2004 when I moved, started doing it more of a on a large scale. Personally invested in many states on over the years, many properties, did some flips, multiple states that I can remember that we've been active in, such as Arizona, Oklahoma, Florida, Texas, Arkansas, Alabama, North Carolina, Georgia, Idaho, Utah, Missouri, Kansas, Tennessee. I think there's a few more, maybe one or two or three more, multiple metros. Been doing this before the crash of 2008, throughout and, you know, during the crash of 2008, and obviously after the crash of 2008. So for me, the crash of 2008, which I keep mentioning, was very much of a growth, growth period. Not all pleasant. I always joke if I am a survivor of the crash, a beneficiary of the crash. I don't know what's skipping here. Survivor of the crash. I'm gonna try to figure out why it's skipping by itself.
Okay, maybe not. Sorry about that. Sorry, survivor, a graduate, someone who benefited from the crash. Those are all kind of things that I went through. You know, the crash of 2008, I've gained a lot of knowledge, information, etc. And I made a promise to myself that I will bring it back to the people that I work with, help them investing, all those lessons learned, all those bad lessons, good lessons, lessons altogether, and share it with my clients so they can use my experience, learn from my experience, benefit from my experience, everything that worked or didn't work, so they can do better. Maybe I can, maybe that crash of 2008 did not happen for, it did happen for a reason for me, so I can bring it back. Maybe that's just the karma. I don't know, but that's just kind of the promise I made to myself when working with my clients. Since 2004 till today, we're still active. We've helped our clients buy something along the lines of 5,000 rental properties in multiple U.S. states. All of them own them outright directly. We help facilitate that purchase. Primarily single family homes, some fourplexes, some duplexes, a little bit land, a little bit commercial, and other things. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. My experience, I have served in the Israeli military for 3 years in the special forces. So that's definitely something that I've done in my past. Glad that I had that experience. Glad it's over as well. My style, by the way, of presenting is really taking questions as much as I can. It's a little bit challenging format for questions while I speak. I like to have a conversation. I definitely like to stay as much as needed, take questions, or it's going to be challenging for you to kick me off the screen unless you guys hit the leave button and move on with your evening. So definitely I'm going to be here for questions. I do want to say a little bit of warning or kind of multiple warnings. First of all, if you're expecting this kind of presentation to have some sort of a sales pitch, you're not going to have any sales pitch at the end. So no sales pitch. I'm not selling a boot camp. I'm not selling product tapes, anything, program, nothing. This is more educational. My philosophy is if anyone an opportunity to share the knowledge. If anyone wants to engage with our services, they will reach out. So if you're expecting some sort of sales pitch, ain't going to happen. Sorry to disappoint you. And I wanna add one more new day, new era, kind of a warning or maybe clarification. I'm a real person. All the information generated in this presentation is actually by real experience. And this is not by any way AI powered whatsoever. So if you're looking for some ChatGPT kind of a content here, ain't gonna happen. This is real life, real experience. That's what I try to bring to the table. So this presentation is AI free. Maybe that should be, you know, free range AI, so to speak. Okay, what am I gonna talk about, kind of touch on as much as I can? I'm hoping to talk about the how to have a presentation not act out. That seems to be a bit of a challenge tonight. I have no idea why. Worked well earlier. Yes. Okay. Some of the what I call the US real estate fundamentals. I'm going to talk about choosing a market, a little bit on selecting a property. I'll go through the purchase process and how to get started, how to get ready, etc. So that's going to be I'm going to cover with details, with examples. So hopefully you can follow. If I'm moving too fast, let me know, or something is not clear, you know, say, hey, can you repeat that? I'll definitely try and do that. I want to start by, first of all, talk about what I consider the mortgage miracle, right? So what is the mortgage miracle? Obviously, you know by now, I grew up in Israel. I'm a foreigner to this country. I've been here for 20 years, but I'm still a foreigner. When you come from other countries or when you know how other financial system operates, you have to be blown away, amazed by how mortgages are being handle or process in this country. And when I say the word mortgage, I mean your conventional, traditional, simple 30-year mortgage. I'm not talking about commercial mortgage, or I'm not talking about hard money. I'm not talking about, you know, ARM. I'm just gonna keep it simple, because we need to understand the basic, the fundamental, in order to move forward. The 30-year residential conventional mortgage, right? Why is this what I call the mortgage miracle? Well, in this country, when we borrow our mortgage, right? When we borrow to buy a house, the mortgage is not indexed, is not pegged to the cost of living. Why am I emphasizing it? It may be obvious to a lot of you. Many other countries around the world, your mortgage is pegged, is indexed to the cost of living. If you know what I'm talking about and you have seen what's happening out there in other countries, you will perfectly understand what I'm talking about. Let me give you an example. Let's just say we bought a house 10 years ago for $300,000. And let's just say for a moment, we borrowed $200,000 and our mortgage payments were $1,000 a month, right? I'm keeping everything simple and round just for the simplicity, right? So 10 years ago, $250,000, right? My mortgage as of 10 years ago, whatever the rate was at the time, is $1,000 a month, right? That's it. I'm paying $1,000, right? Fast forward 10 years, we know all too well what the inflation did in this country in the past 10 years. It went crazy, right? Especially in the past few years. What did not change? My mortgage payments. I'm still paying $1,000. That is an example how the mortgage behaves in the US. Now let's take the same example, same number, same everything in a different country. Let's just say somewhere in Europe, that mortgage that started at $1,000 a month, $1,000 a month, 10 years later, with the cost of living increasing, you know, the index, the inflation, we are now paying $2,500 a month, right? So the mortgage payment went up year after year after year, right? So if you really understand how the mortgage is not indexed, is not pegged to the cost of living, and you borrow and hold it for a lengthy period of time in this country, you will understand how this is benefiting you. Because while cost of fuel and rent and property taxes and, you know, going to the restaurant and everything keeps going up, right? As we know very well, especially the past few years, what did not change? My mortgage payments, right? Assuming I didn't do anything, any changes, I didn't refinance, that does not change. So if we really understand this, a little bit of an abstract concept, you understand that in this country, it's a unique gift to us, people who live in this country. In this country, we have a gift. It's called a fixed rate, unpegged, not pegged to the cost of living mortgage, right? That is an amazing gift for us, you know, the borrower. So that's fundamental number one and really important to understand. Fundamental number two, leverage. Very obvious. We know that. Most of us know that when we buy real estate, we borrow 80%, 75%, whatever, 70% of the cost of the property. The rest we're bringing, you know, our own cash as what's called down payment. And we're leveraging our down payment. We're leveraging funds to buy, you know, a bigger piece of property. There's nothing new about it, right? What I want you to, when you're thinking about leverage, I want you to think about it a little bit differently. First of all, right? First of all, in real estate, it's relatively easy to leverage our 20% using the 80% from the bank, right? So there's a big leverage, a big proportion between what I need to bring down and how much money I can borrow, right? 80-20, 75-25, that's pretty good ratio between my own cash and how much I can borrow, you know, leverage it. The reason it's really important to understand or not take it for granted is because when we go to the world and we're not out there to do business, to borrow, we know in most cases, right? In most cases, maybe cars is also an exception, but in most cases, when we want to borrow for a business or for something else, usually the bank is not going to give us that much of ratio between our cash and the borrowed money, right? If we go and want to start a business or buy a store or do something else, maybe they'll borrow us 50%, maybe not even that. The terms are not going to be as great. So there's a really, you know, the concept of leverage, which we all understand how it works, when it comes to real estate, it's actually very beneficial for us. How much money do we actually need and how much we can leverage and use? So that is very powerful tool in the first way of looking at leverage. The second way I look at leverage, and this is a little bit challenging to do in many times, but not impossible, right? Is when I borrow money and I'm leveraging, actually I have someone else coming in and paying down my debt, right? So I have a debt, my mortgage, I owe money when I borrow to buy a piece of real estate. When I say someone else, I mean the tenant, the renter who comes in, pays the rent. Hopefully if we've done everything, and we can, but it's tricky, but we can, bought correctly, we buy a house that the rent that's coming in is going to cover the fixed costs that we have with the house, which I will cover what they are in a few minutes, and the debt service, the mortgage, the mortgage payments, and maybe even leaves us after all the expenses and the mortgage payment, maybe $100 or $200 a month every month. It's doable. It's getting to be harder with the high interest rate, but it is something that's still available and doable, right? So we have leveraging our money to get someone else to practically pay for our debt and pay for the expenses and maybe leave us with the cash flow. That for me is it's a beautiful scenario, which is very hard to create in other financial vehicles, right? When you go to stocks and options, that's not really how it works. When you go to borrow against a business or you do some startup, those mechanisms do not really play out in that way. So Mortgage Miracle helps us with keeping our costs low over the long term. Leveraging helps us to buy a big piece of asset using smaller amount of money that we have. And we have someone else that comes and pays for it and pays the fixed expenses, et cetera. So it's a beautiful financial tool or vehicle, if you really think about it. That's the way I like to think about our investment as more of a financial vehicle. And there's a little bit more than all those things, right? So when we buy real estate, we have tax benefits or tax deduction, right? The best way to look at it is this. The IRS consider a rental property as a small business, right? It's a business operation. It's a business activity. It operates like a business. It doesn't operate like a house, like a home. It's a business. So that means it's a business. A business has expenses, for example, that you can deduct. For example, the mortgage interest, the repairs, the property management, the HOA, some legal advice. You travel to check, you flew out, spend two nights at the hotel in Nashville while there was a good concert and you had dinners and you rented the car. Deducted, right? So all those things and more are acceptable, if we don't abuse it, acceptable deductions, right? So first of all, we have all those deductions. On the top of that, the IRS says it's a business. You have a business depreciation. You need to depreciate your business. So you can actually be profitable, make money on an annual basis in the bank, actual money, then you're still reporting a loss, right? So that's because of the depreciation. It may take down, reduce your positive profits into a negative tax, on tax or on paper for tax purposes numbers, right? So that's an additional. In some instances, we may even be able, I'm not going to dive into it right now, to use those tax benefits, negative reported income, right? It's a loss on a tax return towards our ordinary income. So for us, many times we're looking for ways how to reduce our tax burden. In some instances, right, we may be able to use real estate towards our ordinary income. It's a little bit more complicated. We can, if we have time towards the end, I'll be happy to elaborate on that. So on the top of everything I mentioned, the mortgage miracle, the leverage, we have some tax benefits, tax deductions that we can use. Now, the way I really like to look at every one of those properties, and again, my slideshow has its own AI engine that I am not aware. The way I look at any of those rental properties is like a small side business, right? Now, why do I love this side business idea? Well, let me just be very clear about it, because I think real estate, if bought correctly, can behave almost, not 100%, but almost as a passive income. And I'm very careful by saying, if anyone thinks this is a passive income kind of a mechanism, I think you're very wrong about it. It is not. But on the other end, I don't think it's a full-time job either, right? So if we have a scale of passive income where everybody wants to be, or a lot of people aspire to be here, and then we have a very active income or side business or work, there is a scale, right? Real estate can be very close to passive income, not 100% passive income. And compared to other solutions, other businesses, side hustles, side businesses that we may explore in our life, that can be, you know, one of the most almost passive income kind of a side business. And now, why am I emphasizing that? Is because when I work with clients many times for many years, I keep hearing that beyond what they do for a living in their job, in their primary ordinary income job, W-2 many times, they also do something else on the side, right? They train people, they build websites, they do some marketing, advise, you know, provide, you know, a consultant, etc. Why do they do that? For different reasons, more income, maybe something for the fun, maybe to give that to the community, whatever. It's all good, right? But it's a side business. The problem is that a lot of us have kids and work and life, and it's very hard to squeeze in, even if we want to, another side hustle, side business. Well, real estate can be one of those places or one of those vehicles that can be incorporated into our life as a side business. If we understand it's not 100% passive, so it does require some of our time and attention. And if we're willing to pay that, not even 1 hour a week on average, then it will probably be something that we can incorporate into our life. And the one other thing I like this about this idea of side business concept is that we can actually start multiple such businesses, right? So if we understand it's not passive 100%, and we have a little bit of time, maybe a few hours a week that we can, you know, we can put towards some our side business, that type of real estate or that type of business can be duplicated. We buy one, you know, take some time to make a decision, make an offer, etc. We buy it, we rent it, even if we work with property managers. And then once it's rented, it's starting generating. What do we do next? We buy another one, and we duplicate, right? We can go one at a time, one, and then move a little bit faster, a little bit slower. But the idea is that I can generate multiple such side businesses while I incorporate it into my busy lifestyle, right? All my clients claim we're super busy, we don't have time. The fact that the real estate does not take so much of their time is something that they see that they value very much. So far we talked about the benefits and, you know, some of the good things that real estate has. I want to also talk about what I call the disadvantages. It's not all perfect, right? I know it sounds like it's not. What are the main feature or disadvantages that real estate has that I want you to understand that for me are the challenge of, you know, the main challenges? I'm not talking about the operational, that of course, but the main ones, right? The fundamental disadvantages. Number one is what I call time or timer. Real estate, if you look back into history, really, really, really loves time. Really loves time. Buy a piece of property, in most cases, even if you didn't do a perfect decision, give it time, it will probably be okay. Meaning, slowly appreciate, even if it doesn't appreciate in a straight line, it may go a little bit up and down, but over time, real estate tends to appreciate over time, right? So that's something we don't always have, enough time or patience. So disadvantage, fundamental disadvantage number one, timer, it's time. Where timer is actually, it's not really working in your favor for you as a piece of real estate, starting to accumulate wealth for you slowly until you buy it, right? So you have to own it in order for the timer, the wealth timer, to really start kicking in, clicking in, right? So time and timer, that's one. Second thing, You need cash to buy real estate. Now, let me emphasize a few things. Over my career, I have been talking, I've seen people say you don't need money, there's no cash. Yes, there are different real estate related investment avenues that are not necessarily real estate, rental properties that may require little or no cash. Honestly, when it comes to owning rental properties, to this day, I came close a few times to do no money kind of deals, even those never happened. So realistically, I think that someone who's looking for the no cash deal, there's gotta be something into that deal that doesn't work well, or cash is delayed, or you can be creative. It's not that, simple as it may sound, because there's always some like a hidden fee somewhere, or hidden cost, not fee necessarily, cost. So my experience is you do need some cash in order to buy a nice piece of property. So some of us don't have that cash. That's a challenge. Some of us do. Some of us may have cash, but not enough. And that's one of the reasons we go out of state. I'm going to talk about that as well. So going out of state, definitely out of state being not in California, not in the expensive states. I know we have people from different parts of the country. So going out to other parts of the country where quality real estate is not as expensive, just requires less cash. So that's part of the reasons we tend to go out of state. The last thing I want to mention is when you buy real estate, do expect some drama, right? This is not HGTV type of drama, but some drama. What do I call drama or drama issues? Well, realistically, you will have vacancies. Vacancies are part of owning real estate, so expect that. Not necessarily lengthy 6 months vacancies, but to have a month every other year, maybe even 2 months every other year, definitely something that you should expect and will happen, right? It could maybe not happen every year or every other year, but that vacancy is part of it. Second thing, if you work with property managers, guess what? Even the good ones are always going to disappoint you one way or another eventually. Not disappoint you to the point of I have to terminate and I have to fire them, but just I expected one thing, they said something, I told them one thing, they didn't. Friction of communication, good intentions that are not always materializing in the best possible way. Property managers will, it's kind of miscommunication with the property managers will happen, right? Repairs is something that will take place. Again, doesn't mean that every month you're going to have $1,000 repairs, right? It could, that's extreme. It could, normally it looks like nothing, 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 something at $200, nothing, nothing, nothing. $300, right? Something along those lines, and maybe in between tenants, when tenants are moving in and out, maybe a little bit more updating. That's how usually it works. So it will happen, I promise. And lastly, eviction. Now, eviction is something that could happen more frequency and could happen less frequency, right? Less frequent. How do you go about it? Well, it depends on the state, and it depends on the type of properties and the type of renters you're targeting by going to certain areas. So there is a way to mitigate the chances of eviction, right? Which we do. We definitely take that into consideration. So eviction will happen. The question, how we perceive it is that if we know eviction will happen eventually, let's at least try to choose the type of property, location, area, etc., and vet tenants in the most possible in a way that reduce the chances and frequency of getting evictions, right? So we do have evictions. They're actually very quite rare, not rare completely, but we don't have a lot of eviction in our system. So evictions are going to be there. Don't be intimidated. It's all about, when you see in the way I look at it is when there is a risk, there is a fear. It's all about understanding it, maybe breaking it down into components and saying, okay, how do I tackle? How do I mitigate? How do I reduce the chances, right? So it's not about eliminating it. I wish we could. It's more about how to handle when that materialize. How do we handle when a fear or risk materialize? And maybe instead of it materializing, what action steps, decisions we can make in order to reduce the chance of something like this happening altogether. So that's how we see those things. Again, remember, there will be friction, issues, drama. It's part of the part of owning real estate. Next, I want to talk about how I perceive, based on my experience, what is considered a good area, a good metro to invest in, and what are the criteria I am following. This is my recipe. I've been using that recipe for many, many years, and it worked well. So first of all, I look at the size of the population of a certain metro. How many people live in this metro? My number is I like to be at 1 million people and above, right? That's my indicator. Most of the metros we are in, except one, are actually more than 2 million people, right? So size really matters in this case. And by the way, the way I look at what I consider is a good metro or indication of a good metro is I'm looking for the resilient factor. Someone like myself that has been through the crash of 2008, resilient is something very, very important for me. Super important. So I always want to see what are the resilient factors of a metro in order to make sure that a resilient for me tells me that when a downturn, slowdown in the economy, you know, arrives, which I expect it to come eventually or sometimes, what are the chances of this metro to survive that downturn, economical slowdown, right? That's kind of my mindset. Is I call it the resilient factor. Population is part of it. Size of the population. Another thing is how many big employers are present and which industries they are representing or coming from. Meaning, I want to see multiple big employers in different, obviously different sizes, and they're not all sitting on the same industry or category, like entertainment, okay? So banking, hospitality, manufacturing, transportation, government, perfect, right? That creates that blend, right? And what I'm looking for. So multiple and multiple different industries, right? So if there is, the idea is if there's one industry or one employer that's being, something is going through something, right? The location, the metro is still surviving. Again, resilient factor. Then I want to see what is the projected employment growth and population growth of that area. I want to track I want to make sure that I am buying in places where there is growth. I want more people that will come, our potential buyers, our potential renters are pushing the local economy, are helping prices. This is how I want to be. I don't want to be in places around the country that are shrinking. I know it sounds obvious, but I know people are sometimes going to parts of the country that are showing signs of, you know, out migration, right? I want to have the in migration. Next, I want to make sure I'm in areas, locations around the country that the laws are landlord friendly, right? We live in a country where some states are more tenant friendly and some states are more landlord friendly, right? I want to be in the ones that are more landlord friendly. As a rule of thumb, usually if you're in a red state, that's a landlord friendly state. If you're in a blue state, that's a landlord friendly state. A tenant friendly state. So that's kind of a rule of thumb. Now, I want to tell you something that I've known this concept of landlord friendly for 20 years. I followed that for 20 years, but only maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I realized there's another layer to that point. And the point is when tenants live in a tenant-friendly state, they typically know they live in a tenant-friendly state. And that means they can actually do, let's just call it dirty tricks, so to speak, in order to give us hard time as owners, okay? So they can delay the payment. They can maybe do some, you know, stay longer without paying, etc. That gives them a little bit more power, and their mindset is, I may win, I may, you know, even if I cause some problem, that doesn't mean this guy can evict me rather quickly, right? And they're benefiting. That's not the case in the in the landlord-friendly states, because people know exactly the opposite. I'm in a state that it's more favoring the landlord. This is not favoring me, the tenant. Again, I'm not talking about a situation where a landlord behaves horribly. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm only talking about assuming we are good landlords and we want to provide our tenants with good properties and we want them to pay and behave according to the contract. That's it. We're not looking for extra, which is nice. We're not looking for anything, any, you know, a shortcut. We just want them to uphold their side of the contract, whatever that means, right? And when they don't, that's where we have to step in and use the contract. So the lease agreement, I mean. So for me, that is an indication where I want to be make sure that the tenants are not abusing the system, so to speak, in order to squeeze more rental days without paying out of me, right? So that's really important. It's not just the laws; it's also the culture, the attitude, the understanding who's favoring, you know, who has a little bit more the favorite side of the law, so to speak. Then, of course, we want to make sure the purchase price rent ratio makes sense, right? So if I live in Orange County and I can buy a $2 million home and rent it for $6,000, that's a horrible math, you know, ratio where I can go to Missouri, to Nashville, to Kansas City, to St. Louis, buy a nice house for $300,000 and rent it for $2,300, right? So that means if I buy a $2 million home in California based on the Missouri numbers, I need to be able to rent it for probably $14,000, not $6,000, you know, more than double. So that's where we're looking for. It's not just about a nice metro and population. The numbers need to, you know, need to make sense. And by the way, if you have been using what's known as the 1% rule of thumb, right? If you don't know what it is, that's great. If you don't, tell me, you know, put a note in the chat and I will explain. But the 1% rule of thumb is actually could be a very misleading indicator when looking at the rent purchase price ratio. And lastly is weather. And now this is something I added a few years back. And what I should actually call it, not weather, but more like harsh weather. So I learned over the years that I don't want to be in harsh weather environments, harsh winter primarily, because in a harsh winter, it's harder to sell a house if you're looking to sell exactly in December, because people just don't want to go out and see and check and drive and as much. It's not such a fun experience. In harsh winters, it's hard to list the house for the same reason. In a harsh winter, it also the chances of the vacant property, you know, heater breaking exactly when the house is vacant, there's nobody's there to see, and then all whatever it comes out of it, even if we have insurance, are just greater. So for me, I've learned over the years, it's not that I have not invested in harsh winter areas, but I rather avoid them, right? Tampa in December, no problem showing houses, right? Nobody's gonna freeze to death. Nobody is wearing their winter coat, right, so to speak, or you know, gloves. So that's easy, even if they wanna sell or to rent a house. So harsh winters are not my favorite areas. By the way, it so happens, harsh winters, I guess that's how they call it, blue states and red states. I guess those are hot states and cold states. So maybe that's the reason or how they became about the colors, right? Probably a different reason, but just coincidentally. Let's talk a little bit about analyzing rental properties. And I want to share with you, let's just see, did I miss anything? Okay. What I call our analysis Excel sheet. This is the model Excel that we use, and I've been using it for 14 years, 15 years or so, give or take. I think that by now it has, somewhere around 60 to 70,000 properties were analyzed using this model. That means all our agents are using it, all our clients, investors are using it. I use it on a daily basis. So this is a tool that we use a lot. And this is what I call a more of a comprehensive business plan, right? Or business plan for the property as a template. Because all we have to do is, it's an Excel, plug in the property details, the purchase assumptions, which is what they're asking, what is the suggested offer, what is the market value, how much improvements make ready we need to do, what are the closing costs, mortgage costs, etc. That's section B. In section C, I put in the mortgage information. Maybe it's cash, maybe it's finance, 20% down, 25% down, 30% down, whatever that is. 30 years or different, right? So in section C, I put the mortgage information. In section D, we plug in the expenses, the income, what we estimate to be the range of the rent, upper and lower. And then all the expenses, the property taxes, the insurance, the repairs, the property management fee, the leasing fee, the cost to place it, it's called leasing fee or tenant placement fee. The HOA, if we have one, we do factor in some vacancy and we get all our fixed costs, our total costs for the property. And this is obviously an Excel, so that will take any number you want. But what we teach everybody who's using this Excel, our clients, the agent, is what I call realistic case scenario. So I've been analyzing properties for 20 years. In my early days, I used what's called worst case scenario. When you do a worst case scenario, you get worst case. And when you have a worst case, your decision is not to buy because it's worse. It's terrible, right? And I've seen over the years, a few years into it, that this concept of worst case, it just doesn't work. Because I have a cemetery full of great deals I didn't do because the worst case, they didn't survive. Now, we all know we can't do the best case, right? That's too optimistic. So I told myself I need some sort of a philosophical aspect. So I teach everybody, I call it the realistic case scenario. And in the realistic case scenario, I try to be a little bit conservative, right? Not overly conservative, a little bit conservative in order to build some buffers. If I'm not sure what the rent, maybe I'll knock it down at 50 to 100 bucks, right? If I'm not sure exactly what the property taxes would be, I maybe increase it a little bit, etc., etc., etc. We don't know all the figures when we put the details together. I have no idea what exactly the insurance rate. I only have experience for this property in this area based on the years. I don't know how the repairs will be. I'm giving an estimate, right? So I'm using some common sense. I'm using experience. I'm using some cautious. I'm not going to the optimistic case. I'm not going to the worst case. That's why I call it realistic case scenario with a little bit of conservatism. Right now, what this Excel, and there are more sections that are just not shown here, more assumptions. What this Excel does very well, it takes all the numbers and it puts them in the background in what we call the analysis engine. And the analysis engine stretches all the assumptions over a period of 30 years, year by year. So I can go in and check in year 7, how much appreciation I have, how much mortgage I paid, what is the rent based on the increase that we use? What are the expenses based on the increase? How much debt do I have? All those things I can go year by year by year and know exactly how the property is expected to perform, right? Remember, this is a model, a prediction based on assumptions, based on the figures that we know. And what I like about this, it's just been used a lot, right? A lot of properties, a lot of analysis has been done to kind of really pound into this model. So it's definitely not perfect, but it's a good model to use. What you're seeing towards the bottom on the right, where it says financial analysis deal attractiveness, right? Below section D, is we take the analysis engine in the background and we just take periodic averages. What's the performance of this property in the first 5 years or the first 10 years, 15 and 20? Because I think it's better to look at the long-term buy and hold rental property, not what's the performance on the first year, but how is it performing at least in the first five, ideally 10. Let's just look at the first five and then And then how much gain in cash flow, equity, et cetera, we're going to have in the first 5 years. And then what's the average cash flow per year in the first five, per month in the first five, what is my ROI, et cetera. And that's how we use. I got to the point in my life that if I look at a property and I'm not putting the details into the Excel, I feel blind. So I trust myself as a rule of thumb every day, right? I've been doing it for such a long time. It's second nature. To this day, I get a feel that it's fine. I really want to understand. Take the 5 minutes it takes me to aggregate all the information properly, make sure it's kind of almost like a structure. I got to put this number. It's almost like a de facto checklist. Everything is in place. I've done everything. I didn't skip anything. Good. Let's see how the numbers are right now, right? So even though I have a good feel, I don't trust myself not to use the Excel. That is where I am with this this kind of a tool. This Excel is something that all our clients get to use. And anyone who's not a client of Simply Do It, who wants to use it, also have access to it, but it's going to be purchased, right? So if you want to purchase this one, I don't remember exactly, is it, $65 or something like this? You go to simplydoit.net/Excel and you can buy it and use it. It comes with a tutorial video. It's not complicated to use. It definitely takes the first time or two, the first one or two, maybe 10, 15 minutes per property to kind of get an understanding how to use it. I want to talk about how I measure the return, because if you're looking at the Excel, I'm going to skip back, and you're looking at the bottom and you're seeing an annual ROI for this property, annual ROI or average annual ROI, 17.7%. 17.7%, some may say it's pretty high. How can you get to that much of a number? It seems good, too good to be true. So first of all, I want to make sure you understand that my baseline for calculation, the ROI, the return on investment, is what you're seeing at the section C, last line. It says cash outlay, total out of pocket, $97,680, right? What is this figure? That's my baseline for ROI. That means how much money I shelled out to get this property, not just to acquire it, but acquire plus get it operational, ready for a tenant. Meaning I spent closing costs and mortgage costs and additional expenses to get it updated or fixed up a little bit, maybe only $7,000, $5,000, whatever, to get it to the point that now I can take in a tenant, okay? So it's not just my down payment, in this case, almost $90,000, it's almost $10,000 above, in addition, right? So that's my baseline. Very important that I use that number and not just the down payment. And that's my baseline. Now, on the baseline, I look at what I call the total ROI. I look at three growth vectors. One is the cash on cash. Cash on cash is how much cash is left in my pocket before taxes, but in my pocket after everything I'm seeing here in expenses. In this example, in the first 5 years, on average per year in the first five, you will see it says 1486, almost $1,500, right? That's my actual cash flow per year in the first 5 years, average one per year, right? So that is my cash on cash compared to my cash outlay. So number one is cash on cash. Number two return is return on equity. Year after year after year, the rent comes in, and part of the expenses is the mortgage payments. Mortgage payments are principal and interest. Principal and interest. So that means slowly I'm paying down the mortgage principal every time, the mortgage principal is reduced by $1,000. That's another $1,000, in equity that belongs to me in the house. I'm not meeting it in the bank account just yet. I'm not seeing it in my pocket. I'm only going to meet that equity when I either sell or refinance or do something along those lines. But right now it's in the house, but it's actual money. If I sell tomorrow, that's something that will be there, right? So return on equity is number one. Mortgage, you know, it's mortgage principal reduction slowly. The second thing is appreciation. Very loose term. I got to be careful how I use it, right? What is appreciation? Obviously, or not obviously, the property value goes up year after year after year. Not obviously, because we have seen years, personally, crash of 2008, that the property value crashed down, right? So I got to be very careful. How do I use the appreciation responsibly, right? I should say, please use responsibly. Is I consider the appreciation as a 3 to 4% average annual increase in value year after year. Why am I using 3 or 4%? Because on one hand, over the long term, it's not zero. We've seen that it's not zero, right? So it's just saying I don't believe in appreciation over the past 70 years have been proven differently. On the other hand, just because we had few crazy years and it appreciated 10, 12, whatever percent more per year or whatever, I cannot trust that as well. That for me just it's crazy. So I'm very good with what we used to call normal, regular inflation of 3 or 4%, or on average over time, it's probably very reasonable to use. So I'm careful with using it, but I'm not ignoring it and I'm not abusing it, right? So appreciation is something I like to use 3 to 4%. By the way, guess what? It's Excel. You can say, I don't believe in appreciation, put zero. That's okay. You can say, Danny, you're too conservative. I think you should use 6%, which I actually tend to agree. Go ahead and do that, right? The Excel really knows how to digest a lot. So those are my three growth vectors, which I consider the total ROI of a property. Cash flow, a little bit of appreciation, a little bit of principal reduction, and over time, they each grow or benefit me. A lot of people are just focused on the cash flow. I get it. I understand if you're focused only on the cash flow, you will not be happy with the returns many times. I've just seen over the years that when you are not just focusing on the cash flow, but actually on the total ROI, you'll probably be very happy with the results, especially even if one of them didn't work well. Let's just say the cash flow was much less, appreciation was okay, nice. It's like mitigating, vice versa, right? So those are couple of things you probably want to or keep or think about or understand, and not just focus on just appreciation or just cash flow. Okay, my friends, let's talk about the purchase process. So I'm gonna kind of go through the main steps without diving into every one of them. But typically, once you identify the market you want to buy in, and I hope you have a reliable local team, maybe our team in that market. That's what we have, multiple teams in different markets. And I will tell a little bit more about how we go and what we do in a moment. And you have identified a property, you're going to submit an offer, or the agent is going to submit our agent hopefully will submit your offer. If we may go through some negotiation with the seller, once everybody agrees, we sign an acceptance and we send over the earnest money, the deposit, right? So we do have that, we start escrow. Send the money and deposit. We're next going to do an inspection, usually within 3 to 4 days after going on the contract. We'll have an inspection. Inspector goes to the property, produces a full report, what's going on with the property, all the problems, all the issues, big and small, right? Those can be very clean and those can be, in most cases, messy, right? But we have to decipher them. So we have an inspection. If everything is fine with the inspection, we're going to start and we maybe negotiate a little bit with the seller after the inspection to reduce the price or fix few things or give us some credit. And if we agree on the outcome of the inspection, we're going to proceed into into towards the closing date. We already have a closing date, a settlement date set. In that date is where the seller signs and notarizes, you sign and notarize. Lender make sure they're ready to send the funds. You're sending the rest of the funds because you only send the earnest money so far. Escrow company is gonna get all the documents, get all the funds, make sure everything is fine. You know, they have a, like this balance sheet. And if once everything is fine, signed, covered, they will distribute the funds to the seller, to the agents, to the county, to the first mortgage of the, you know, the current mortgage of the seller, etc. And then the title company will take the details, go to the county, to the county, record the property to your name. That means recording, and you are now the owner of that property. Recording actually shows public records. You know, it takes maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, month and a half, two, depends on the county. And then officially, you are the owner of that property. Congratulations, right? Now that you are the owner, I hope that you have that you have a property management. If you work with us, you will. If you don't, you know, you got to find yourself a property management so they can go through the process of prepping the property. We call it the make ready, and then putting out, you know, advertise it for leasing, vet tenant, show the house, find the tenant, hopefully quickly rent it out, and so on, right? So that's kind of in a very high level, what is the purchase process of a rental of a property, not just a rental property. I want to make sure, maybe it's obvious, but who's responsible for what, okay? So as a landlord, you are typically responsible for taxes, property taxes, that is, property insurance, property management, repairs, HOAs, and cover vacancies. As a tenant, you will be responsible for paying the rental deposit, and the utilities. The exception sometimes on the utilities could be if we are buying a duplex, I would say a fourplex, it's more likely. Maybe some of the utilities are on the owner's responsibility, or all the utilities are on the owner's responsibility. That could happen as well, but probably the tenant is paying something towards that as well. So there could be exceptions to the rule, of course. Now, when you're considering going out of state, investing in real estate, locally or out of state, you probably want to have, you want to make sure you have what I call the team. It's a team effort, right? So a good, reliable, knowledgeable about investment properties agent is really important. A property manager that knows what they're doing, that have good systems and processes in place, that's been around, it's also very important. Someone that can fix up the property, if it's not coming through the property manager, it would be preferable. Maybe the property manager, maybe someone that's coming from the property, not with the property manager, a lender, of course, and ideally a mentor. A mentor is someone like me. I talk to my clients on a daily basis because they have specific situations, scenarios, challenges. On a daily basis, something happens with the property manager. Just an example, today, one call was reviewing an inspection that came that was done yesterday to go over the details and kind of decide what to do next. Another call was another client that is debating if to make an offer of this one or the other one, two properties. We had a conversation about which one, how to tackle it, so on. A third investor is actually saying, listen, I think I want to sell one of my properties in Fort Worth. I'm not sure. Want to run it by me. How to go, what they should do. The house is vacant. Who should they talk to, etc. Even when we're selling, it's a, you know, there's some challenges. He wants to buy another property. So naturally, the conversation is went into the what we call the 1031 exchange mechanism. So he can sell one, buy another, and defer taxes. I'm not diving into it right now, but that's just a typical day having, you know, different facets of the business, helping the client with different challenges, speaking to an agent, speaking to property managers, speaking to a lender. That's a common day for us. Plus, keep working on the regular stuff of finding properties, helping, you know, the agents analyze them, etc. In addition, it's really good if you have a good insurance agent, which we do, attorney, sometimes it's necessary, not always, someone that'll do your accounting or taxes, and maybe financial advisor to do a more of a big picture. So for me, from the secondary power team, what I call the insurance agent is probably the one I speak to the most, finding, providing quotes, etc. The others are just more on occasion on where when needed. So let's just use an example. This is a property in the Birmingham, Alabama area. It's in Helena. Helena is a really good area, a really good city, town, schools, etc., off the Birmingham metro. This one is listed for, it's a 3-2, 1,200 square feet, built in 98, two-car garage, no HOA, listed for 240. Market value is about 240. The down payment will be 72. Closing cost, repair, etc., 8,000. So this house needs about $80,000 in order to purchase it. And the rent on this one is estimated at $1,650. This one is not relevant. I'm just using it as an example. This is not something that you can buy today. Just to give you some tangible, what are we talking about? In the analysis, you can see the average cash flow here is not high. It's about almost $1,000 per year, which is not a lot. You have to remember we have a high interest rate. It's very challenging. And this one specifically is also the rent purchase price ratio is on the lower ratio than what we see. So it's not horrific, but it's definitely lower than what we normally see. Normally for us, I would say a $240,000 home would probably be about $1,850. So that would be an additional $100, $150-ish more per month. The annual ROI based on the $80,000 investment is 17.2. So it kind of even lives very interestingly with the example that I show in the analysis earlier. So this is just an example of one house. We get asked a lot of questions about real estate on a daily basis. And those are some of those questions that we've been asked. We kind of looked at the different ones we got asked. I'm not going to cover all of them right now. I just want to show you that within those many questions that we get, the number one questions that we keep getting is, how do I get started? Right? I'll come back to this one, but how do I get started? Let me just jump forward in a moment. And that always surprised me when I've realized that's the number one question is how do I get started? Because I do webinars and we have a podcast and YouTube and there's a lot of information, but still it seems like bringing it all together is challenging for people. And I get it. I really get it. So I want to suggest a few ways how you can get started and give you some clarity, right? So first of all, in our world of real estate, the Simply Do It world of real estate, we normally don't buy anything less than 200,000. Can you buy cheaper properties than that? Absolutely. We don't touch anything less than that or around that number just because we know we're going to start making compromises on the quality of the property, the location, the school, the age, etc. So we normally start at 200-ish. If we really want to squeeze it and want to put only 20% down, which I'm not sure you want to, but just in case, so you're going to need about $50,000 if you're putting 20% down, not my best recommendation, but let's just say, which with additional closing costs, repair fees, etc., you're looking at about $65,000. So if you really want to say how much bare minimum do I need, about 65 in our world of real estate, right? Again, you can buy for less. You can actually buy a whole piece of property for 65, not with us. Right? We don't touch those properties. Cash flow on this property would be about $1,500 a year, give or take. And the total ROI, based on how I explained, would be approximately 15%, right? So if you're looking to get started and you want to be, you know, with using as little money as possible, that would probably be the case. I would say this is because it's 20% down. This is not what we normally suggest to our clients because of the interest rate. We can dive into that. What do you need to do in order to get started? 65-70,000 or more, qualify for a loan. I'm going to assume everybody here can qualify for a loan. You don't have to be super wealthy to qualify for a loan, but you have to go through a pre-qualification process, which we can help you with that as well. We have lenders in our network as well. And commitment. So this is really, really important. I've learned over the years, no matter how experienced I am, no matter how systems and processes and checklists and education I have, if the other, if the party I'm working with, the client is not committed, nothing's gonna happen, right? So nobody, I'm not gonna force you into buying. If you are tired because you're busy, I get it. Kids, work, whatever, traveling, I really get it. That is where you have to ask yourself, am I committed, right? Committed means I need to put some time into finding the property with Simply Do It, putting the offer, going through the steps, etc. It's not going to happen just by itself. So commitment, time and energy is important. We are very good with helping, simplifying, saving time, so you don't have to run around the country and analyze properties and look for properties and find who to work with. We've done a lot of the heavy lifting, but if you are not putting the time, the commitment, that's never going to happen. I wanted to share a little bit the metros that we have properties in. You can see Tampa, Orlando, Atlanta, Greater Nashville, St. Louis, a little bit, in the some in Indianapolis and Chicago, not anymore, used to Kansas City, Oklahoma, Dallas, Houston, Phoenix, Salt Lake City, Boise. So we are well diverse in the metros right now. These days, we are very much focused on Kansas City, St. Louis, Nashville, Birmingham, and actually at Tampa. We are just decided to come back and resume activity in Tampa. We do have teams in other parts, such as in Dallas and in Houston and in Orlando and others, but those are more sleepy cells, right? We don't do much over there at the moment because those local metros, local markets are not as attractive as the other ones. So right now, primarily active in the greater metro of Kansas City, St. Louis, Greater Nashville, Birmingham. Those are the top four. And Tampa is like the fifth one of the ones that we are, active in as we speak. I want to say a few words about what we do, because I mainly talked about real estate and what we do, what Simply Do It, my company that I founded many years ago. We just simply put, we help investors buy investment properties, rental properties in different parts of the country. Our approach is very simple: buy and hold long term. We don't do commercial, we don't flip houses, we don't do heavy renovation, and we don't do construction, and we don't do Airbnb and short-term rentals and all of that. Very much focused on single-family homes, duplexes, fourplexes, many times with mortgages in different parts of the country, right? We help our clients decide where to buy, what to buy, go through the process of all this leading pre-buying questions, understanding, challenges before we even start looking at properties. Then we start looking at properties together with you, helping you make a decision which one is relevant for you based on your knowledge, experience, budget, fears, etc. And we introduce you to our teams. So they source properties, filter properties, send them to you. We review them together, decide on which one to make an offer and which one not. Once an offer gets accepted, we go and make sure you are smooth through the process of buying that property that you put on the contract and getting as good as possible, as safe as possible to the closing. And then we have property managers in place that are going to be, introduced to you early on, so you know who's going to manage the property. We have lenders that will help you, insurance people, etc. Vetted teams, everybody that we work with, not everybody, mainly the property managers and property managers, lenders, and agents. We carefully choose them. We want to make sure those are reliable people. They know what they're doing. We train the agents very carefully how to analyze, how to work with the Excel, how to present the information, what qualifies, what doesn't qualify. It's a lot of filter process, a lot of due diligence, down to the details, systems and processes. So you can come and say, listen, Danny, I'm super busy. I have some time. I want to invest. It's always been challenging for me. Can you help me? Where to buy? What to buy? How do I know it's a good property? How do I know the inspection is done well? What if the inspection is really messy? What if this? What if this? And we stay on and support you after you purchase, meaning a year later, 6 months later, a month later, 5 years later. Something comes up with the property management. Something comes up with the property. You're not sure how to handle, what to do. Who do you talk to? We're going to be here. Say, hey, let me talk to the property manager, find out what needs to be done. Let me call the property manager, say, and put my force. All the property management the companies that we work with, Simply Do It is their biggest account. You're going to be part of the biggest account. It means discount on their fees, additional activities that that they don't normally do to regular clients. They will provide you and better service. And on the top of that, when something happens and you need some, what I like to call the big brother, and I'm a big guy, trust me, to call in and find out and make sure and validate and confirm and check and push and nudge in addition to that, right? So we, so on the top of everything, you have someone on your corner that will help you overcome challenges, talk to the property manager if needed, suggest just ideas to solve problems, help you continue investing if that's what you want to do, help you consider selling and maybe doing a 1031 exchange like I had a conversation today. Those are all part of our service and how we perceive this is not just, hey, here's a property, buy, see you around. Yes, it really is the core of what we do, but there's a lot of services, a lot of activities, a lot of support that comes around, because many of us, even when we purchase once or none, or multiple times, it's always good to have someone that you know you can trust, you can talk to, you can have an honest answer, and to know that you haven't missed anything, or maybe you missed something and I would point it out, etc. I always tell my clients, I'll always tell you what I think about a property. I like it, I don't like it, why do I like it, why I don't like it. I do like it, however, I would want you to look into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? Those is the kind of conversations I'm having with my clients. I want to build really good long-term relationships. Long-term relationships prove to have you coming back and buying a second, a third, a fourth, and more. And you coming back and say, and sorry, you going back to your friends and say, hey, this guy knows what he's talking about. This company is good. I work with them. You know, even when things did not happen, you know, did not go according to the plan or smoothly, they were there to help. They guide me through the process. They showed me what to do. You know, it's a comprehensive, you know, kind of support that we look at it, not just go buy a house in Kansas City, right? We can do that. On the top of that, I'm almost done. If you want to tap in your questions, on the top of that, we do have a new program, actually an old program coming back, where we do what we call the co-ownership. Co-ownership is something that we offer some of our clients who are interested to actually buy with another client or two or three, right? So that means co-ownership, because you are exactly like owners of a property, but instead of directly owning, you have, and working with the property managers, there may be three or four owners, maybe five. We have an operation manager, someone who oversees the communication and oversees the challenges and communicates with the property manager and navigates this package of people, and lack of a better term, you know, herding all of the owners together. The owners are still the owners. This is just someone who outsources the decisions, the day-to-day operations, and still work with the property manager, right? This is something that is beneficial for people who do not have enough funds, maybe don't have $70,000 available and want to put in a smaller amount. Or someone says, listen, I'm so busy, I'd rather be just even more passive. I take the passive, the corner position. Someone who says, you know what, financing, no financing, let me just spread my funds over multiple co-owner properties. This is how we go about it. So it's the same type of properties. We just structured the deal a little bit differently. And it's really important to understand you are a co-owner with other co-owners and an operation manager, very similar to how you are owning a property outright. So that is another option. And yes, the co-ownership program will be as part of an LLC. There's an LLC that will be, the property is going to be held in. Every owner is a member of the LLC. The operation manager is just a manager of the LLC, of the operations. And that's how we structure this co-ownership program, right? Some of the benefits of working with us, I would say, beyond to what I've said earlier, is that we have the tools, the checklist, the systems and processes to kind of keep you on track. We have vetted properties, you know, vetted people, you know, analyzed properties that we are, you know, presented to you. So we're not just sending properties just because here's a property. And we also have what we call the insider's deal. So anybody who signed up to our program, they are get exposed to the, first of all, to the properties that we have to offer before we send those properties out to our general database, right? So normally you'll get the first dibs, first access to the properties. Most times those properties do not last the inner circle, the insiders and the outsider, outsiders do not get exposed to those properties. The way we work, the way we engage with you, if you're interested, we're going to ask you if you want to meet with us, if you want to talk to us, you know, we're going to ask you to complete our intake form. It's very 3 to 4 minutes, simple, no credit card, no personal questions, no loan application. Once we do the strategy session, then we have you sign our document, engagement documents. Once you sign them, we hold a kickoff. A kickoff is very step-by-step what's going to happen in the coming weeks. A lot of calibrating expectations. We're going to introduce you to our local teams, review properties, submit offers, and then acquire the property. So this is, you know, a highlight of the process, how we work. Before I dive into our different social media links and take some questions, I'm just going to mention that if you want to meet with me one-on-one, what you can do is go to our intake form, simply doit.net/intake, and then complete it. We will get in touch with you. We can sign up for a time in person. If you're in Orange County, Southern California, phone, Zoom, 30, 45 minutes, free, no sales pitch, no other, you know, the strategy session is really opportunity for you to come up and say, Danny, I have a specific question. I have follow-up questions that you didn't cover in the session. I want to run some specific scenario by you. So it's kind of take it down to a more intimate environment. You and me talking about what is challenging you, bothering you, concerning you, questions that you have. And then based on that, you will be able to determine if we are a good fit for you and if you are also a good fit for us. So this is how we go about the strategy session. And then before we open up for questions, I just want to mention that we have a lot of education out there, right? Our YouTube channel with hundreds of videos on YouTube, simply do it /simplydoit1. On anchor.fm, which is now Spotify, but it's you can still use that link, anchor.fm /simplydoit. We have our podcast channel with 150 episodes, maybe a little bit more. We have simplydoit.net. If you want to see some properties, what the type of properties we are looking at, you can go to reistar.com. This is a lot of the properties that we are considering. Some of them we're buying, some of them we're not. We're not putting there only the beautiful, the sexy ones. We don't do that. We just want to use the reistar.com as a more of a tangible website so you can see, feel, look at photos, look at numbers of the type of properties we are considering. All right, let me see here if we have any questions. Okay, some comments. I'm going to stop the share to see if there's more information coming. So with that said, I am done with everything I wanted to cover. If you have any questions, I'll take them now. I'm going to wait for a lengthy moment here. You can unmute. Moritz, you want to ask something?
Hi. Yeah, sure. Hi, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Just a quick question. I was interested So I think I heard correctly that the co-ownership program, that is still the same type of property. So it's not like apartment complex syndication, right? Is that did I hear that right?
Yes, so exactly. So think about it. You're buying with three other partners that are not necessarily your friend. They could be, but no, that's not what we're aiming for. A single family home or a fourplex, right? If there's going to be a multi-unit, it will be up to a fourplex. So those will be exactly the same properties we are considering on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're just slicing it a little bit different. Single owner, you know, co-owners.
Got it.
Perfect. Excellent. Okay. If that's what we have so far for questions, I'm going to wait another 10, 15 seconds. And if that's it, we're going to wrap it up for tonight. We are an hour and a half. Yep. One more.
Another okay. One. No problem.
Yes. No problem.
I think the part, maybe I missed it in the presentation, was the part how you make money. so I think...
You didn't miss that. I'll tell you exactly. the way we get compensated is you pay us a fee when you buy a property. So we have a fee for a paired property. We call it a paired door or paired unit fee. The fee is higher on the first door or unit that we work on, and then it drops down on any additional door afterwards. So we charge a higher one on the first one because that usually the more support and questions, and then it drops. It's somewhere between 1,000 to 4 for the first one, right? For the first one around 4, there's few options, so around 4, and then it drops up to around 1,000. So just to give you a ballpark, when we have a conversation one-on-one, we can dive into that. I just want to give you a more of a ballpark figure. We also get paid a compensation from the agents that we work with, and that's part of their commission. So it's not something you need to pay on in addition. So the only additional cost is this door unit fee. Higher one on the first, you know, reduces on any additional one.
And that goes, that's a one-time cost. It's not like a subscription.
No, it's a one-time cost. If you feel more comfortable with subscription, we can work something out, you know. Yeah, the one per transaction, per door, per, you know, yeah, but not a monthly fee.
Got it. Okay, thanks.
You can have your co-asker join the screen as well. It's okay.
I was asking my co-asker if she has questions, but it didn't.
No.
Hi, co-asker. How are you?
Hi.
Yeah, no. I see you. I saw you coming in and out of the frame. So if you have any questions, by all means, feel free to ask. No problem.
I guess, like, of all of the cities, the metro areas that you shared with us, which ones are you most excited about, like, for if we wanted to invest, let's say, sometime, you know, in the short term?
Right. In the what?
In this year or next year.
Okay. So I want to tell you that I'll answer it in two ways. First of all, I think Birmingham is really exciting in many ways. I think it's not one of those that are really quadruple, whatever, crazy, and has a lot of potential. So I think Birmingham is really exciting as a personal preference. My true answer, I will tell you that instead of trying to guess which one, I like to work with my clients and say, out of those, this is the better one for you, right? Because it could be a budget. So we all have budget constraints, but some of my clients can, like I have a client right now, they're buying house number 2. They have barely enough for $200,000, right? The best property they can probably buy for that amount would be Birmingham, okay? However, my client that actually is targeting duplexes and fourplexes is better and has more, a bigger budget, is probably going to be more situated well in Kansas City, because Kansas City, we do see quality duplexes and fourplexes more than any other ones, right? They all do have, you know, duplexes and fourplexes, but not as many, not as quality ones. So you see, what I'm trying to say is I try to kind of tailor it and say, yes, I can give you a simple answer, but that would be Danny's preference. I don't want to work with you with my preference. I want to work with you to meet your preferences, right? Whatever those preferences are, and they say, I know I said Birmingham, but actually Nashville is the right one for you. Just as an example.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Right. Perfect. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. One more? No? All right. All right. Very good. Thank you, everyone, for sticking. And thank you for those who actually had to drop and actually left a note that you had to drop. I appreciate it. If you want to meet with me, speak with me, I'm sure you have the contact information. You reach out. We set up a time, complete the intake, and have a conversation in person, you know, in person, phone, Zoom, whatever. With that being said, have a terrific night. Enjoy the rest of your night. And I hope to talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.